Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, and welcome to Great Loop Radio, brought to you every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time by America's Great Loop Cruisers Association. AGLCA and our Admiral sponsors, Dog River Marina and Boat Works, Dozier's Regatta Point Yachting Center, Dozier's Waterway Guide and Magazine, Green Turtle Bay Resort, Marina Life, Richardson's Map Tech, Passage Maker Trawler Fest, and Skipper Bob Publications invite you to join us as we explore the Great Loop every Friday morning with a show chock full of information that's useful to you whether you're dreaming of, in the midst of, or planning a trip around the Great Loop. And don't forget to visit our ship store at www.greatloop.org/ship-store. Thanks and enjoy the show.
Hi, everyone. The Homeport crew is here again. I'm Beth and Steve. Hi, guys. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Briefly, again, for those people that aren't familiar with the Great Loop, there is actually a continuous waterway that includes the eastern portion of North America. It encompasses the Atlantic, the Gulf Intracoastal Waterways, the Great Lakes, the Canadian Heritage Canals, and also the inland rivers of America's heartland. The trip is about 6,000 miles, and most people actually do it in about a year. Several people do it in segments over summers if they're not retired. Our website is www.greatloop.org, and we were formed to get people information to inspire them and help them through the cruise. Our guest host this week is Brian Hicks. Brian is a Metro columnist at the very, very, very popular Post and Courier newspaper in Charleston, South Carolina. Brian has authored or co-authored 6 books, including Raising the Hunley. And the Hunley is the topic of our discussion today. If anyone has any questions or comments during the show, please feel free to call in. The toll-free number is 877-497-1815, and we do encourage questions. Brian, why don't you start to tell us the story of the Hunley, please?
Well, where should we begin? You know, the Hunley, for anybody who doesn't know, is a Civil War-era submarine that was built in Mobile, Alabama in 1863 and was the third sub in its line. James McClintock, who designed and built the Hunley, had built 2 before that. And the Hunley benefited from those years of research and development. It was brought to Charleston in August of 1863 to try to break the Union blockade of Charleston Harbor. And they had some trouble with it at first. They sank it off James Island in August of 1863. Then they sank it in the harbor again in October of 63, and that killed the better part of 2 crews. And they refurbished it and set out from the north end of Sullivan's Island on February 17, 1864, went about 4 miles offshore, planted a 90-pound charge in the side of the USS Housatonic, and sank it. And that became the first successful submarine attack in history. And about 45 minutes after that attack, the sub disappeared, and no one saw it again until 2000 when it was raised off the coast of Sullivan's Island.
Brian, are you there?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
That was just sort of kind of the opening spiel introduction, I guess.
Fantastic. Thank you. I'm not sure how many of our listeners are actually informed about the whole issue of the Hunley, so that was a good beginning. Thank you. Why don't you tell us something about the discovery and the raising of the Hunley?
Well, the Hunley disappeared, as I said, and anyway, it was missing for more than a century. A lot of people looked for it, and it wasn't really officially found until Clive Cussler's dive team, the adventure novelist, had funded some guys to go out and look for it, and they found it in May of 1995. And a year later, the National Park Service went out there and confirmed the find.
Brian, why do you think it was so difficult to find? I mean, most people knew it was right in the Charleston area.
Well, I'll tell you, because everyone who had looked for the Hunley assumed that it was lost on the way back in, and they started their search at the wreckage of the Housatonic and worked their way into shore. And in fact, the Hunley was found about a quarter mile farther out to sea than the Housatonic, and that's why no one found it. An interesting little story about that is that Cussler had been interested in the Hunley from an early age, and he first set up a dive team to go look for it in 1980. And they came out and they took a magnetometer, which is basically like a metal detector you drag behind the boat, and they went out and they marked targets that might be the Hunley. I think they found maybe 13 or more. And they went back the next year in 81 and started diving on some of those that they thought were the most likely sites. And nothing worked out. And there were two or three more expeditions over the next decade or so. And in 1995, Ralph Wilbanks and his crew found the Hunley. It was actually at the site of the first hit they got in 1980.
Huh.
And so if they had stopped looking when they had their first hit, they would have found it 15 years earlier.
Oh, my goodness.
But I told Clive that I appreciated that, because if he'd found it in 1980, I was in junior high school and wouldn't have got to read the book about it. But,
Brian, how did you get involved with the Hunley?
Well, I was actually, I'm from Tennessee, and I was living in Nashville and was on vacation in Charleston and was in town the day the Park Service confirmed it's the Hunley. And I was looking, going out to the beach one morning. I picked up a copy of the newspaper. It's what newspaper people do whenever they're in whatever town. And the headline on the front page of the Posting Courier was, "It's the Hunley." And I had no clue what that was. And read the story and thought, wow, I would really like to be doing that. And a year later, I called the newspaper and got a job here and started covering the sub recovery soon after that.
Uh-huh. When did you write your book on raising the Hunley?
We started writing that in October of 2000. It was recovered in August of 2000. And we had the book sold by the end of the year and wrote it into 2000 through most of 2001, and it came out in March of 2002. And since then, there have been a lot of new discoveries and things. We basically were working on the book through the initial phase of the excavation. After they recovered the sub, they took it to the Hunley Lab, the Warren Lash Conservation Center in North Charleston, which is on the old Navy base, and they opened the sub. They took a few of the hull plates off the top of it and started digging through it. The sub was filled with basically what looked like pluff mud, and they went through it finding artifacts and the remains of the crew, and pretty much we had to wrap up the book about the same time they were ending the excavation.
Why don't you tell us something about the actual physicality of raising the Hunley? How did they do that?
Well, they found the Hunley in about 30 feet of water, and it was 4 or 5 feet under the sand, under the ocean floor. And that's probably a result of the jetties. You know, when they built the jetties in the late 19th century, it sort of disrupted the flow of sand on Morris Island. Barely exist anymore, and the sand covered the Hunley and buried it deep, which is another reason people didn't find it early on.
Uh-huh.
And so what they did when they found it, they dug down to it and they put 2 pillars at either end of the sub, and then they lowered this truss onto the to rest on these pillars, these platforms. And divers burrowed under the sub and connected straps on one side of the truss, went under the sub, and came back up on the other side. I think there were 30 or 40 of those. And then they brought in a barge crane and lifted the truss, cradling the Hunley at the same attitude that it was found. It was kind of listing to one side.
Uh-huh.
So they pulled it up like that. It took them months to get this ready, and then took them about 15 seconds to pull it out of the water.
That must have been fascinating to see. If I remember correctly, that weren't there boats allowed somewhere fairly close to watch the raising?
Yeah, there was an entire fleet out there around it. They had a perimeter set up. You couldn't get too close, of course, but there were a ton of boats on the water that day. It was not too bad out there. You could watch it without too much trouble. And then they put it on a barge, and they barged it into the harbor, and most of these boats followed it all the way in. It went through the harbor. I remember that the traffic stopped on the old Cooper River bridges when the people were watching it.
It must have been fascinating. I wished I had seen it. How long did it take to get into the harbor from the raising?
They raised it about, it was close to 8:30 when they raised it.
That early in the morning?
Yeah, they started early. They thought it would get, the chop would get worse as the day went on. And I think by the time they had it secure and did everything out there, they arrived at the Navy base around 1 or 2 that afternoon, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And then they used two or three different cranes to get it into the lab and into the tank where it sits to this day. In fact, just last week, they finally removed that truss. It had been hanging there in those straps at that same attitude since 2000, and that was pretty much its safety net. That's how they were holding it. And then this past summer, they rotated it to an upright position and set it down on a little bit of a platform that sort of is like load cells, and they can see how much it weighs. And they never have told me how much it weighs exactly, but they set it up and, you know, braced it so it wouldn't tip over. And then last week they lifted the truss off, which gives you a much better view of the sub. I mean, this truss was a pretty hardcore piece of equipment, as you might imagine. It really has obscured the view. When you go see the Hunley on tours, it was kind of hard. You had to look through this truss to see it, and now it's just sitting there.
Still sitting under fresh water?
It is for the moment. They are in the process now of switching the tank out. They've been keeping it in cold water to sort of slow the rust process. And what they're about to start doing is treating it with chemicals that will kind of leach out all this 130-something years of salt water that had, you know, gotten into the metal. And so it won't be in fresh water. It'll be in some sort of caustic chemicals probably within 6 months or so.
Cool.
I don't know how, if at all, that will affect the viewing of it when you go see it, but you can definitely right now see it a lot better than you could.
Brian, I think we're going to break for a quick minute just to have a word from one of our sponsors. We'll pick up again in a minute.
Okay.
Did you know that every mile of the Great Loop is covered by both the Waterway Guide and Skipper Bob? Use them to plan your Great Loop cruise and learn about the places you can visit. In the cockpit, important navigation info is always ready at your side, plus marina listings, anchorages, services, and so much more. Each Skipper Bob and Waterway Guide is updated yearly, and waterwayguide.com and skipperbob.net keep you current with navigation alerts, cruising news, fuel prices, and special deals. With the Waterway Guide and Skipper Bob at the helm, you'll always be on course. Order yours today at the AGLCA Ship Store at greatloop.org. Waterway Guide and Skipper Bob are proud sponsors at the Admiral level with AGLCA.
Thanks, Beth. Brian, okay, now they got the Hunley raised, and it was filled with what you said looked like plus mud?
Yeah, it was kind of a mixture of sand and mud.
process of getting all of that out and not disturbing the remains as much as possible?
It was a very slow process. They scooped it out with probably with tools that were roughly the size of teaspoons.
Oh, I cannot imagine. How many people were on the crew to recover it?
There were eight.
I'm sorry, recover the remains.
Oh, wow! I couldn't even count. At least a half dozen, maybe more, scientists were in there working. I mean, it was a pretty confined space, and only so many people could do it at one time. They started by taking two or three of the hull plates off that were between the conning towers on this sub, and they had to drill out the rivets and take those off. And so they were working in very small spaces, probably just, 3 or 4 feet wide. And it took months. I think they started in February of 01, and they didn't really finish the initial phase of digging until the end of May. And that's because they had to go through there, and they were charting the exact location, three-dimensionally, of everything they found, down to hair follicles. And so it was pretty painstaking. I remember about a month in, they found the first button off somebody's coat. And then they started finding pipes and eventually canteens. That came a little later. They were stored under the bench that the crew sat on. They found the first remains maybe a few weeks in. It seemed one of the crew members was near the top of the sub. He was not in his seat exactly. He was on top of something else in the sub. And so they came across him. It was actually, I think they've identified those remains as Arnold Becker, who was maybe 19 or 20 years old.
Brian, I've seen the Hunley. It's absolutely fascinating. But what just fascinated me was the size of it. And how many men were in this submarine?
There were eight men inside the sub.
And what about the measurements of the men? Were they big men? Were they? I mean, I cannot imagine. A tall person fitting into this sub.
Well, that was always sort of the conventional wisdom that you would find that these were slight, small men, and it turned out not to be the case. I think the average height was about 5'10". There was one guy who was 6 foot, and there were only a couple of guys who were, I think the shortest may have been 5'6", but most of them were 5'8", 5'9", in that range. So they were average-sized men. Studying their remains, they found that they had the one Becker that I mentioned was a kid, 19 or 20. Some of them were as old as their mid-40s. And these were guys who'd seen a lot of action. A lot of them had back problems, but I can only imagine that being on the Hunley would give you back problems. The way they had to sit, the sub is maybe 4.5 feet wide, and they would have to sit on this bench and rest their feet on the opposite wall of the sub and then bend over and turn this crank that powered the propeller. And that's what they did. So they got down in there. There was no movement, no walking around. When you climbed into that sub, you were sitting where you were sitting.
And, what was the average length of time that the men would be on the sub for any operation?
They would go out for hours at a time. And they really didn't have a whole lot of missions, so to speak. They trained on it for a while. This final crew did the most training. The other two crews basically perished on their first trips. But when the final crew got aboard, they would go out for a couple hours. Sometimes would go out and spend most of the night out there. They would ride out with the tide and come in with the tide, which suggests a pretty long duration.
Sure.
They had there was a snorkel system on board where they could go under the water and have air come in through there, but they didn't really understand how it worked. It didn't work very well. I joke, it's sort of like, you know, VCRs and everybody's clock flashing 12, that it's just, you know, they don't worry about those kind of details. What they mainly did was they traveled on the surface a lot and opened the hatches every now and then to refresh their air. Once they decided to see how long they could hold out without fresh air, and so they took the sub behind Sullivan's Island into, I guess, what's the waterway now, and settled down on the bottom and decided to time how long before they needed fresh air. And they made a bad mistake because one of them said, all right, the first guy who can't take it anymore, scream out. And that's just not the kind of challenge you throw out to military guys. And so they all just sat there and took it.
Oh, my goodness.
According to later stories, and I don't know if this was to save face or what, they all sort of screamed at it once, all right, let's go. And they started pumping the water out of the ballast tank so the sub would surface. But the back tank wouldn't pump. There was something wrong with the pump. And William Alexander, who was serving as the first officer at that time, was sitting in the back of the sub next to that pump. And in the pitch black, he reached down, took the pump apart by hand, found that there was some seaweed or some kind of grass clogging up the pump, took it apart, took the grass out, put it back together, and started pumping, and they surfaced. And they were down for not quite 2.5 hours, but it was long enough that the troops on Sullivan's Island had already reported that they were dead.
Brian, from the time that they all said, okay, enough, this pump was repaired and they surfaced, how much time elapsed?
I think just a few minutes.
Okay, because that must have been horrible. Now,
yeah.
If I remember correctly, this was all, like you said, this was all pitch black. I mean, there were no lights in the Hunley.
Yeah. They had candles, but at that point
there wasn't. That comes to mind.
It.
The first two crews perished.
Yes.
How did they get the third crew? Was it voluntary or was it mandatory?
It was voluntary.
Really? I cannot imagine the courage and adventure of this third crew.
I like to compare them to, they're sort of the 19th century version of astronauts.
Uh-huh.
They were, you know, guys with the right stuff, and they were willing to brave this new technology going into a hostile environment. And George Dixon, the captain, had his pick of the men. He got a lot of volunteers. The interesting thing about this is a lot of people call it the CSS Hunley, as Confederate Station. Wasn't. It was in fact a privateer. It was built with private money, and what was going on was that rich prisoners were offering rewards for sinking ships that were blockading Charleston, and these guys built the Hunley with the idea that they would get a $50,000 reward for sinking certain ships and $100,000 if they could sink the New Ironsides, which was, you know, pretty much the baddest ship in the blockade. And they brought it to Charleston at the request of General Beauregard, who was in charge of the defense of Charleston. And they were more than happy to do it because this is where they needed to be to make money. When they came over here, McClintock came with it, the man who built it, and tested it for a while. And the Confederate military, this was during one of the heavy bombardments of Fort Sumter, and they were getting desperate, and they finally seized the ship. The Confederate military seized the ship, and they were going to go out and try to stop these blockade ships with it. Well, they didn't know enough about it, and they actually sank it at the dock at Fort Johnson. And the captain was climbing in when it sank, and he jumped back, and the man closest to each hatch on the sub got out, and the five in the middle died. They recovered the sub, mainly to bury the bodies, which they actually found before the Hunley was raised in about 1999. They were buried in the old sailor cemetery and were under the booster room at the Citadel football stadium. Because that whole area where the football field is used to be a Confederate cemetery.
Uh-huh.
Well, Horace Hunley came to town, the sub's namesake, and he asked for the military to give him his ship back, and they did. They said, well, it doesn't work anyway. You can have it. He brought in some guys from Mobile who had helped build the sub, and they took it out, and Hunley himself decided to pilot it, and which was a mistake. Hunley was a money guy. He wasn't really much of a seaman. And so he went out, and he sank it in the middle of the harbor October 15th, 1863, basically because when they submerged, they let water into the ballast tank, and then to surface, they would pump that water out. Well, he opened the valve to let the water into the ballast tank, but he didn't close it. And the ballast tanks were open to the crew compartment, and that water eventually flooded in and drowned them all. And that's what happened there. And so they recovered it, and that's when George Dixon and William Alexander. Alexander was a very talented engineer who I think had a lot to do. He's probably the Hunley's second father behind McClintock. And Dixon and Alexander raised the crew. Oddly enough, just 2 weeks before the Hunley went out and sank the Housatonic, Alexander was called back to Mobile. They needed him for something else. So he was not lost on the Hunley, and he's actually the source of most of these stories about what happened to it.
Brian, we're almost out of time. Just some things that come to mind. I mean, the story is fascinating. How does an author such as yourself, the story of what happened with the pump, how do you find that out? And how do you find out exactly what happened hundreds of years ago?
It's a lot of digging through memoirs and old newspaper accounts and letters that have to do, you know, correspondence during the war provided a lot of this stuff. Alexander actually lived into the 20th century, and in 1902, I think, gave a very long interview, especially for those days, to one of the New Orleans papers, and they printed it. Took up nearly an entire page of the newspaper with him recounting these stories and the thing about them being behind Sullivan's Island and the pump being broken. That's all stuff from Alexander.
Uh-huh.
Dixon tells some of the story. It's funny, a couple of years after the book came out, someone in Texas, I believe, surfaced with letters from Dixon that he'd written to his former landlord in Mobile. This person was descended from the landlord. And Dixon tells a few of these stories and talks about what things are, and oddly enough, they jibe with what everybody else said. I mean, they add some new texture to the story, but it goes along pretty much with what everybody was saying.
We need to finish up, Brian. Tell us where the Hunley is now and how people can visit it if they're interested and how they can learn more, please.
Well, the Hunley is at the Old Navy Base in North Charleston. It's at the Warren Lash Conservation Center on Supply Street. And they have tours on the weekend, I think, from 10 to 5 on Saturdays and noon to 5 on Sundays, and I think you can go on eTix to get tickets, or you can probably just show up. They have tours every 20 minutes, and you can see the sub and basically all the pieces they've taken off of it, and some of the artifacts that they found inside it are on display. I think it's $12 to get in. And they sell, they still have Raising the Hunley, the book on the sub, and they have National Geographic video on sub, and things like that will tell you more about it.
Brian, this has been fascinating. Brian is a very, very busy columnist, and I really appreciate the time you've taken to help us out. The Friends of the Hunley are actively seeking funds. You can find information at www.hunley, that's HUNLEY.org. And if you've missed this show live, I'll post it in our discussion forum. It will be archived. Brian, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, no problem. Glad to do it.
Okay, Steve, I think we're ready to end.
Okay, bye-bye, everybody. See you next week.
Thank you,
bye.
Everyone. Bye.
Thanks a lot.